Thank you very much indeed, Panos. I particularly liked the quiz on international flags that was incorporated into your presentation there. I was particularly stumped by Rwanda. Thank you for helping me out with that. Homelessness, as we all know, is a killer. Most of us can expect to live well into our 80s. The average age of death for a homeless person in the UK for a man is 47. For a homeless woman, it's 43. Those figures may have changed a little bit in the last year or two. But I did note in Dennis's presentation that it's 64 in the United States. So
if you're 50, your likelihood is to be 64.
Okay, but that's obviously not quite the same thing. But anyway, we do know that this is a particular problem. And while most of us will succumb to disease of some kind. That's what's going to get us. For homeless people, the causes are much more varied. It's traffic accidents, it's overdoses, suicide, infections, of course, falls. And without family or friends to support them in their final days, dying actually can be a terrifying prospect, far more terrifying perhaps than for the rest of us, for homeless people. So what kind of end-of-life care should be available? It's a good question. And to consider the need for integrated palliative care for homeless people, we have two speakers from Canada. We have a double act from Canada, ladies and gentlemen. Marg Smeaton is the Director of Health Services at the Mission Hospice in Ottawa. Wendy Muckle is the Executive Director of Ottawa Inner City Health, Inc. Marg Smeaton and Wendy Muckle, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Good morning. We'd like to speak to you about how we consider providing end-of-life care for Ottawa's homeless. We're pretty unique, I think. I haven't heard of anyone else who is doing this. But we actually have a hospice, a palliative care hospice, which is situated within a shelter in downtown Ottawa. It's a men's shelter, but we serve men and women both in our hospice. And we've been open since 2001. As everyone has been hearing throughout the course of these last day and a half, is that age-adjusted life expectancy is 25 to 30 years less than housed Canadians. We've been hearing about all the reasons for that, and certainly lifestyle is one of the at the forefront. They've usually had difficult lives with very poor coping skills. It's very hard to learn coping skills when your life has been chaos from the time that you've been a very small child, and you don't have someone patterning or letting you know how to make decisions and how to come to decisions that will be the right ones for your life. There's a higher burden of illness among the homeless population for sure, and the lack of natural caregiving systems. Most of the people who are homeless and on the streets are certainly estranged from their families. They come to street families for sure, who give them that nurturing, but street families can be fairly transient. So they're lacking anyone who is there permanently who can sit with them and help them through the difficulties of their life. They lack appropriate housing, and that impedes them getting health care. It's very difficult for someone to go to their family doctor and sit in a waiting room and wait to be seen when they're looked upon by others in the room as you're obviously a street person. There may be some mental illness. It's difficult to sit there for that long. There's certainly addictions issues, and to wait while you're needing a drink or needing your next fix and waiting in an emerge room for 2 or 3 hours is just not going to happen. Severe mental illness is also very predominant among the street people. So Dame Cicely Saunders said, "You matter because you are. And to the last moment of your life, we will do all that we can to help you live until you die." That's how we run our hospice. People in our hospice are living until the day they die. People have said to me, "You've been in the hospice for a very long time. Do you not find it depressing? Do you not find it hard to deal with on a day-to-day basis?" And I'll say to them, "You know, our hospice is one of the happiest places I go to. People are there living their lives, and we encourage them to live their lives. We celebrate occasions. We have birthday cakes and birthday parties. And we celebrate Christmas and Easter and all the traditions. And we make sure that family, if they are there, are certainly involved in all of these things. And who deserves a good death more than someone who has had a difficult life?" I've had people in our hospice come to me and say, "This is the best place I've ever lived in my life." To me, that's a gratifying statement to say that we're doing it right and people here are living and happy the way they're living. But it's also one of the saddest things I've ever heard, that you have to come to the end of your life to be in a space where you're nurtured and cared for and safe. The benefits to having a hospice, certainly cost effective. It's $125 a day for someone to be in our hospice, compared to the $3,000 a day that it costs to have someone in the hospital. And that's just if they're in a general ward bed. If they're in intensive care, having extra therapies, that cost rises consistently. The demonstrated cost saving is 3-to-1. There's a significant reduction in ER. Street people don't have doctors, and we've sort of talked about why. And so when they have a crisis in their life or anything that's happening to them that they need medical attention, they go to the ER. I don't know what your emergency rooms are like here, but ours are jam-packed, and it's very, very long waits and little tolerance in some of them for people who come in who may be intoxicated and may be high on drugs, but they have a real underlying medical condition that needs to be looked at. Longer life expectancy than in shelter or on the streets, for sure. People come into our hospice, they often haven't seen a doctor before they come to the hospice. They come in and we are the ones who finally find out exactly what's going on with them health-wise. They're given the proper treatments and they're giving their medication on time. They are given 3 meals a day. They have a safe place to sleep. They have people around them who genuinely care about how they're doing. They have people who will just sit and chat with them. We have volunteers who come in regularly and just to be there and be a presence. And I say bring some of the outside world in. We also have, which is my favorite thing, is visits from the local Humane Society. So we have dog visits come in, and sometimes they bring cats as well. And we had one old fellow in our hospice who was in his 80s. He was one of the guys that had made it through many years on the streets. And when he knew it was the day for the dogs to come in, he would get up first thing in the morning, put on his best suit, and sit in the waiting room and just wait for the dogs to arrive. We reconnect people to family and social supports. Family is huge, and many of our guys that come in and our women have burned many bridges for sure, and they're afraid to call family. They're afraid to let the family know where they are. It's been my experience that for the most part, when we call family, they rally around. One fellow said to me, "You can call my one sister. She's the only one who I think is still interested in hearing from me." So I called his one sister, who lived in Montreal, which is about an hour and a half drive from Ottawa. The next morning, 12 family members arrived. They surrounded him in his room, and his mother and two of his sisters stayed with him for the next 2 weeks until he died. So yes, it's a scary proposition for these men and women to get in touch with family who they feel are going to reject them again. I have found that, yes, sometimes there's an initial, "I don't care, I don't want to know." Very seldom does that last for longer than a moment or two, and it's a wonderful thing to see families reconnected. Do you need a hospice? It's very nice. We love our hospice, but end-of-life care is defined by meeting the need and respecting the life choices of the people who we're serving. So Inner City Health, which Wendy is going to talk about in a moment, is an umbrella outfit that the hospice is only a small piece of. They have many more places that are residential care for homeless people for various reasons and in various states. And these places become their home. And lots of people say, "My wish is to die at home." So that's their home. So Inner City Health is a wonderful organization that absolutely meets their needs where they are. And so do they always want to come to the hospice? No, sometimes they want to stay right where they are. But we need to respect the values and traditions of the people that we're serving. And that's something that we're able to do at Inner City Health. I think one way to tell this, we don't have rules about palliative care, and we need to be aware of that. We had one fellow that died in our hospice who had lived his entire life on the streets. He had spent all of his winter sleeping on a heated grate on the sidewalk on a piece of cardboard, and that was where he felt comfortable. He was very mentally ill. We did manage to lure him into the hospice and feed him and look after him, and I think he was quite content to be there, but he just didn't want to sleep on a bed, and we struggled with trying to get him where he needed to be, where we felt he needed to be. One of the cleaners was cleaning up one day and went by with an empty cardboard box, and he asked him for this box. The cleaner said sure. He thought he was packing things away. He opened the box up and put it on the floor in his room, and he lay down in the box, and that's the first time I can say that he slept really at peace. It was hard for the staff to see that. We wanted him in a nice, comfortable bed with a pillow and a comfy blanket. But what we wanted didn't matter. This is what his comfort zone was. And he died on that cardboard box on the floor with staff sitting beside him holding his hand. And that was meeting his need. In the beginning, the hospice opened in 2001 at the height of the AIDS crisis. We were established to provide accessible palliative care to the homeless population. We had 14 beds to begin with. And we were full all of the time. The AIDS crisis has changed, and now AIDS has become a much more manageable disease, and we're not seeing as many AIDS. I don't think there's one in the hospice right now who is AIDS-related. We're seeing cancers and lifestyle diseases for sure. We've gone to 21 beds this year, which has been huge for us. We have 14 acute care beds, but we've gone with 7 chronic care beds because a lot of our population is now aging and they need a place to be. They need some place to stay where they're safe and warm and comfortable. And many of them have been in the mission and in this environment for their whole lives. So we have 7 beds that now we can have the chronic palliative care people. Palliative care is strongly rooted in middle-class white values. We have to differentiate palliative care from other kinds of health services that have created rules and norms which defines palliative care, which does not add value to the lives of the homeless. I think we've talked about that a little bit, but we really have to be conscious, very conscious, of what our population wants and what they need to make their deaths the way they want them to be. So take the best and give back the rest. Remember who we work for. I'll pass this over to you, Wendy.
I'll just explain. It's a little bit confusing sometimes to understand the difference between the mission and Inner City Health. So Inner City Health is an umbrella organization, and we run 9 different programs, of which the hospice, as Marg said, is one of the programs. But palliative care is really a theme that you'll see throughout all of the programs that we operate. So I just want to give a little bit of context and hopefully give a little bit for you to think about. Yesterday we heard a great presentation on recovery, and John, who's one of the presenters, coined this term of enhanced care. And that made me think that, yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do as well. We recognize that culturally, the people who we're working for are really different from what many of the mainstream palliative care providers are used to. And I'm not sure if it's the same here, but in Canada, palliative care was started by the white middle class, and it's supported by the white middle class and promoted by the white middle class. And so it's a wonderful, wonderful service, and they're wonderful, wonderful people, but they're not always the same, and their values are not always the same. And so it's been really hard and at times for us to try to differentiate ourselves from that palliative care and to understand what fits and what doesn't fit. So in the midst of the AIDS crisis, we actually got pushed into palliative care because our people were honestly dying like cockroaches in the street. And the mainstream palliative care community was not that interested in the AIDS world. And our clients, frankly, didn't want to be included in that world. There's very rigid rules and requirements for being in palliative care which just don't fit for them. The behavior and lifestyle, people don't understand. And there was really a lack of connection to the usual people who could get you into palliative care. So people were not being identified to actually even be promoted to the service. How palliative care is offered in the mainstream services in Canada, there's a lot of talking. And it's really important to talk everything out, and it's really important to understand how you feel about everything. For a lot of our clients, that's not something that's terribly important to them, and not something that they can tolerate people doing with them. One of our students was telling me, because I had said to her, you know, less talking, more doing, and she said that when she was at the hospice trying to admit a man, she was, you know, asking him questions, and he said to her, whoa, like, you need to shut up and stop asking me questions. And she said, well, I'm a doctor, like, it's the only thing I know how to do. And he said, then you just need to sit with me for a few minutes, and then we'll go from there. So she said, after they sat together for a few minutes and watched TV together, he said, okay, now I'm going to tell you what you need to know and what I want. And she said he was able to do it in about 4 or 5 sentences. And she said it was a really valuable lesson in learning how, you know, a different way of being able to interact with people. And we also recognize that the need for palliative care services occurs much earlier in the trajectory of the disease. And so the rules in Canada about, you know, the services are only provided in the last 3 months of life just don't fit. So we, the, and quite frankly, one of the things, you know, the thing that maybe the undertone of the AIDS crisis that that really caused the palliative care world to not be so interested in it was the fact that people were actively using drugs. And we really had this vision that we would have a place where people could continue to live their lives as they chose and to be respected for who they were. And so our hospice opened in 2001 in what we now call the good old days, because now we don't have the AIDS population, we have a cancer population primarily, and the cancer people are much quieter. And they're not so lively. And so all of us who worked back in the hospice in those days call it the good old days, because it was really wild. With AIDS, you know, one day they were dying and the next day they were not. And when they were not, it was a lot of fun. So we all, and every once in a while we get somebody in the hospice who's a lot livelier than what we typically have. And unlike in regular palliative care services where that person would be excluded, all of us are, yes, it's so much fun. So when we started our hospice, we of course asked our clients what it was that they wanted. And it's interesting, you know, they wanted basically to be allowed to die within their own community and their own culture. And I think that there's no population in the world who would not want that. And they wanted to be, you know, to be treated like people should be treated. But it was also really important for them that they wanted to be remembered. That was the big fear that came out of talking to people, was that they would be forgotten, that their lives would be forgotten, and that they wouldn't be seen as being important. So if you look at that sort of list of what people want, you recognize that this is the list that any community would make for itself. And so it was really important for us in the beginning to develop traditions for what happened when people died in our community, so that people in the community could be assured that all of the important things would in fact be done. And that's an area that we've been very successful in. So as we met triple therapy and AIDS really changed, the face of AIDS really changed, and we moved more into cancer care, increased the life expectancy. So back when we opened, people were dying at about age 45, and now they're dying at about age 52. So we've added more years to life, yahoo. But unfortunately, it means that people live for a much longer time with a lot of chronic diseases. So we were a big success from a survivalist point of view, but somewhat a failure from a quality of life point of view. And so we really had to stop and think about what we were doing, because it's not enough to just continue to do what you're doing when clearly it's not necessarily meeting the need. And if people have worked in palliative care, they know there's this thing called the surprise question, which is, you know, do you think your patient, would you be surprised if your patient was dead within the next year? Well, unfortunately, in our community, that surprise question applies to almost everybody. And so we needed to add a little bit more robustness to that question. And also, very interestingly, people may be dying from one disease but needing active management of other diseases. And so there's this, what they call a purely palliative care approach, didn't fit for what our clients needed, and it certainly didn't fit for what they wanted. The survivalist culture is very strong in our homeless community, and it was something that we really needed to learn to incorporate in our care. So we actually found a tool to help us identify who needed chronic palliative care, which is called the SPIC tool, which actually comes from Glasgow. And we validated the tool in our setting. And it actually works really well in our setting. What it lacks is a sensitivity to the complexity of housing and mental illness. And as we're using it more and more, we're also realizing that it does not allow for the complexity imposed by trauma. And we serve a lot of First Nations, Indigenous people, many of whom are residential school survivors. And so the whole theme of trauma is a huge one within our care systems. And we did try using the tools and measures that the mainstream palliative care system uses, but unfortunately most of those are not terribly helpful. So we really wanted to develop a program of care which is based on reducing suffering and not based on life expectancy. So really focusing on helping people be as healthy as possible and to live as long as possible, because that's what they want for themselves. And focusing on allowing the death process to occur when the person feels that it's time for themselves and when all other options have been exhausted. And again, this really feeds back to the values of compassion and respect for street culture. And I know that street culture is probably the same here as it is in Canada, but just in case it's not, I've just briefly here listed what street culture is. And the big issue is really around the sense of alienation from mainstream society and the assumption that people will be discriminated. and the issue of respect. People who've been the big man or the big woman on the street or who've had an important part of street culture, when they are seen in the mainstream healthcare systems, nobody knows that they at one time were the real deal or the big guy. In our setting and in our culture, they can continue to be and to be respected and to be treated with the status that they once held in society. And I think, again, that's something that all of us would want for ourselves, that we're not diminished from the things that we've achieved in life at the end of our life. And one of the things that is very different about this population than working with other populations is generally there's a lack of fear of death because people have lived a life where people die around them all the time and where they could at any point be dead, and they're well aware of that, so they don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time talking about what it feels like to die. So we've really focused on suffering and on what we can do and what they can do to minimize suffering and extend the quality of their life. And so we a couple of years ago decided that we wanted to implement a chronic palliative care program. And there in Canada, from a policy perspective, there's a policy framework that actually supports the implementation of chronic palliative care with acute palliative care. But in fact, most palliative care organizations and jurisdictions are actually just at the very beginning of that. And we're partway through it, fairly far advanced into it. But our challenge was, of course, that we wanted to implement a chronic palliative care program, but nobody actually was going to fund it for us. And so we had to figure out how we could do it within the resources that we had or new resources that we could obtain. So the next generation for us, as Mark said, we have 14 acute palliative care beds and 7 chronic palliative care beds. So the chronic palliative care beds are reserved for people whose care needs would exceed what you could provide in a supportive housing environment. So people who, for example, need a 2-person lift or transfer, who need a fairly high intensity of the physical care support. Whereas in our supportive housing programs, we're in the process of implementing services to be able to offer people enhanced care, which either will be in the early phases of their disease process, but essentially for the last 2 to 3 years of life. And there's a bit of a fuzzy area between what's good chronic disease management and what's chronic palliative care. And frankly, as long as people get good care, I don't think it really, really matters. And one of the things that we've done that's been very interesting is we implemented, we did a pilot to do a health literacy project at one of our housing programs. So if you read the literature on chronic palliative care, you'll know that the success of chronic palliative care, to a large extent, depends on the health literacy of people to be able to direct their own care and participate in their own care. So this is a huge challenge for us because I would say that generally we have people with extremely poor health literacy, poor all kinds of literacy for a whole variety of reasons. And we've tried many of the, what I'll say, or sort of traditional approaches to palliative or to improving health literacy or health promotion, and none of them really have taken. So one of the things that we knew was that people who live in the supportive housing have a very strong affiliation to each other, and they really wanted to help care for each other. So we decided to do a project to invite people to participate in developing training materials to train people to be peer educators or peer supporters so that when people in their own setting were unwell, they would be in a position to help them. And it was very interesting because people who generally would not necessarily want to get too engaged around improving things for themselves were hugely keen to know more about the diseases and the disease processes so that they could help their neighbors and help each other. And it's been a really interesting project to see how to build on people's strengths, because many of the skills and abilities that people develop from living their lives on the streets for many, many years don't necessarily help them in the housing setting. But in this case, we were really able to build on their strengths, and the Health Literacy Project has been hugely successful, and we're implementing it elsewhere. So just as our wrap-up, and actually I should just say, the lovely lady who's there with the beautiful smile, she has the best sparkling eyes in the world. If you see, her name is Linda, if you see Linda, your day is made because she can make you laugh at any point in time. And she's somebody who we've worked long and hard, A, to get housed, and B, to support, who lives with many, many chronic diseases, but for whom the focus on her suffering has really made huge differences in her lives and in her ability to remain housed and to remain in her own home. So I think that the take-home message from up is just that we hope that you can think about the benefits of end-of-life care to the homeless and defining them by the needs of the populations that you're working with, as opposed to defining them by the rules and regulations of what is palliative care. We strongly believe that end-of-life care is a right of people who are homeless, and that given the circumstances that people are forced to live in, they, of all people in our society, are more deserving of good end-of-life care than anybody else. And the benefits to the individual are obvious, but the benefits to the system are also huge. And particularly to the healthcare system, to the community, if you've worked with people who've had difficult lives, to see them at least have a good death and to feel good about that part of their life does actually provide a lot of inspiration to care providers. But I think most importantly, it's really important to their families and especially to their children. Many children have not good memories of their parents and the role that their parents have played in their lives. And to give them that time at the end of their life where they can, where the responsibilities of taking care of children and all of those things are taken away, and they just have time to be together and to love each other, really not only helps people die peacefully, but I think it really gives a gift to the children and something that will help improve their resiliency for the time to come. And so I think that for all of those reasons, we would really encourage anybody who's not involved in end-of-life care to at least consider how you could incorporate that into the work that you're doing. Thanks.